By the way, this was a stray observation I had just about that trope of sinks in public restrooms. It's something that always completely bothers me in movies and TV. People always seem to be filling up sinks in public restrooms and washing their faces with the water from the basin. And who in their right mind would ever do that? I mean, I know that this is a highly stylized show, and it's a great opening to the scene that his face is dunked in the water and there's blood all around it and all that stuff. But there's so many movies and TV shows that show people doing that in sinks and in like airplane sinks and public restrooms. Come on, who would do something so disgusting? It's horrible.
Okay. I have to say I agree, but I agree. Not only do I agree it would be disgusting to do this in a public restroom, but who has ever done this? Like anywhere, even in your home. Have you ever been like, "Oh, I'm really agitated and I need to calm myself down, so I'm going to fill a sink up with water and stick my head into it." Like that just I have never done that.
Hello, and welcome to a second helping of Hannibal. My name's Matt Unger, and back in March 2020, when the lockdown was really kicking in New York State, my sister Beth and I decided to rewatch Hannibal and, for no real reason, record our conversations about each episode. And now we're publishing it as a podcast in case any other Hannibal obsessives out there will enjoy it. One word of warning. It's all spoilers all the time, both for each episode and the whole show. So if you're in the middle of your first watch, you might want to wait until you're done before you start listening. And also, please bear with us. We didn't really have our recording setups figured out for the first three episodes, so the sound quality is going to vary quite a bit, but it smooths out starting with episode four. All right, with that out of the way, let's get to it.
Okay. So I'm very, very excited because I really, really enjoyed watching that pilot episode, Aperitif. It was great. And despite what we said earlier, it's very hard for me to watch this episode and imagine that I saw it and was like, eh, I'm not really into this show. Because it's fantastic and so much is set up in this pilot for what's going to happen in the future. And like, it's obviously so well constructed and so well thought out, and so, already the visual aesthetic is, in place. I mean, obviously, it would become much more visually elaborate, but there's just, it's a lot of what it becomes is there already.
Yes, in the same way that other great shows like The Sopranos, like Mad Men, The Americans, shows like that, where when you go back and rewatch them and rewatch that first episode, and you just are amazed at how much of the relationships and course of the the course that the relationships are going to take just seems to be laid out immediately. This show really has that. You can go back and look at this first episode and just say to yourself, okay, the themes, the tensions, obviously not all the characters, but the purpose of the show and the course of the relationships is set in motion and really, really, really set up really well. And there's just a very clear line that you can draw from the first episode to the last episode.
Yes, agreed.
So because we were talking about how the show didn't catch on with each of us when we first saw it, that I was watching it very carefully with that in mind this first time around, this first watch of it. So my initial reaction to it now is more about what was it about my initial impression of the first episode that kept me from, because that kept me from enjoying it, or from the show catching on with me. Because I remember now, I don't even think I finished the first episode when I started it. And here is why I think that was the case. We talked about this before, that I think just the physical resemblance between the Will Graham in Hannibal and the Will Graham in Manhunter threw me a little bit into just making me think that this was Manhunter universe and we were in Manhunter universe. So that was one thing. The other thing, I think, the way it opens with the murder and him reconstructing the murder really made a lot of sense to me. And I remember that really grabbing me. What I remember really turning me off, and this is just sometimes what happens in the early episodes of a show, is the expository dialogue with Jack Crawford and Will Graham bugged me when he says, "What? Where on the spectrum are you?" And Will sort of lays out who he is. That just sort of, that level of exposition turns me off just generally. In retrospect, and even just watching it this time, it makes sense because the next time the two of them are interacting, that context is set and it really does matter that you found that stuff out. But the dialogue, that type of dialogue isn't always to my taste.
Yes. Also, they sort of lay Will Graham being on this spectrum in a way that I just don't think is accurate to who he actually is. So, I mean, I suppose in one way you could say this is just sort of Will's way of categorizing himself to somebody else who is not, because he doesn't want to fully be seen. Or you could say this was just sort of the idea of how to explain who he is to the audience. But I just think it's a very narrow way of categorizing who he is and what his gifts or disabilities are.
I agree. I think it goes a long way toward at least explaining why for this first episode, like he always has shadows under his eyes. He doesn't know what to say to people. Like there's like the moment when he asks the murdered, the kidnapped girls,
the cat,
about the cat. Without knowing that there was something wrong with him and having it be overtly stated that he's socially awkward, maybe that would have taken a little time to understand. Although I think that demonstrates it really well and I didn't need to be told, but I do understand why they would set the context that way. But I do agree with you that it is not an accurate description of who he is.
And also, I think it's accomplished by other things, like the way you see Crawford invading his space and him recoiling from having his space invaded. You know, when Jack Crawford is sort of touching his stuff at the lectern. But like even in the scene with when Hannibal first meets him, which is a fantastic scene, and I was really surprised it's not in the first scene, but I was really surprised to see Hannibal use the teacup analogy, like in this first episode, which of course later is something pretty visually and psychologically and emotionally important. But, you know, the conversation about, oh, you don't like to make eye contact. And like, I think I understand it's a pilot and you're explaining things for the audience. And maybe that was necessary, but like that also felt somewhat overt to me.
I think so. I think it's an early sort of, it's almost like a rehearsal, that scene, for the kind of banter that Hannibal and Will are going to have, because Will does parry those observations of Hannibal's in an interesting way. Like when he says, well, here's why I don't like eyes. I worry about the blood vessels. I think, oh, those eyes are so white. So I think it was a good early example of the kind of tennis they're going to play with each other.
Yes, it's they're having it's a weird courtship dance that they're doing with each other, and it is very interesting because I mean Hannibal wants Will from the instant he lays eyes on him, and it's so obvious, and he just begins wooing him immediately. I mean, it just happens so like I was very struck by how quickly it all happens. Like Hannibal gives him his first, you know, meal of human body parts. Hannibal gives him the gift of the copycat negative that reveals to him more information about the actual murderer. Hannibal gives him I mean, Hannibal would see this as a gift, but Hannibal gives him the gift of Will killing somebody, and he gives him the gift of Abigail and binds him. Hannibal binds Will to him by Abigail, and by saving Abigail, and then by in the hospital demonstrating a caring or a connection to Abigail that Will is going to respond to, and like creating them immediately as her surrogate parents. And like it's all in the first episode, which I found pretty remarkable. Right.
And there are also some complexities to the relationship that are revealed there too. Like, yes, it's a gift that Hannibal's giving to Will, but it's also that sort of sadomasochistic relationship that they're going to pursue is laid out in that gift, right? Because the gift, yes, he gives Will the gift of being able to kill someone, but he sabotages the direction that the case is going to take. He puts Will in danger. He enjoys sort of outsmarting Will and manipulating Will into being put into this very difficult position. And I think while yes, it's a gift, but it's also a gift that costs Will a lot to accept, right?
Oh, yeah. When I'm calling it a gift, I mean, it's hard to say what Will, you know, I mean, I guess we'll discuss this as, you know, the show goes on. I mean, Will certainly would not see this as a gift if he knew what had happened, and certainly not at this point. He will evolve, I guess, as to his perception of what Hannibal brings out in him and what Hannibal allows him to do. But I think Will, to start out, is someone who doesn't want to be seen. I mean, he doesn't want to make eye contact because he doesn't want to be seen. He doesn't want to be psychoanalyzed. He knows what his darkness is. He knows what his dreams are. He knows that he can empathize with monsters. And he's very fearful of giving into that darkness. And so to Hannibal, he's, you know, it's a gift of freedom, but to Will, it's like his worst nightmare.
Right. And Hannibal's also showing his seduction methods right away too in this first episode. All throughout that whole episode with Will killing the killer, Hannibal, even at the beginning of the day, it's the first time that the two of them have really been alone together. And Hannibal brings him food, and yes, it's human body parts, but Hannibal takes the opportunity, Jack Crawford's in court, Hannibal takes the opportunity to get some alone time with Will and feed him and make him comfortable and make him laugh a little bit. Hannibal also acts as if he's just giddy to be seeing what Will does for a living. And Will, despite himself, you could see he feels a little, well, this is just how we do it in the FBI, you know, and so Hannibal's given Will a moment of feeling powerful. And then he calls and warns the killer, and he lets it play out until Will is completely disoriented after having killed the guy, and Will is shaking, and Hannibal comes over and then very confidently and authoritatively covers the wound in Abigail's neck in a way that's like, hey, I got this. I'm going to take care of you. I'm going to take care of her. It's very impressive, and it's very manly in a way, right? That in a way that I think Will is incredibly relieved and grateful when Hannibal's able to come over and just take over like that and save her life. And then at the end of that whole episode, there's a great shot where Hannibal like gets Will's gratitude. Now he's almost made Will dependent on him throughout this whole episode. And then Hannibal just gets into the ambulance and drives off with the medical personnel. Like, okay, I'm a doctor. Now I have to go do my job. Leaving Will wanting more almost, right? It is like,
yes.
You know, it's almost like dad's gone off to work.
Yes. And there's just sort of something else I was thinking about, and this is just in terms of Hannibal's original attraction to Will, which is, you know, you see him with, I'm forgetting the name of that patient, Franklin. You see Hannibal with Franklin, and you can see, first of all, Hannibal is so bored by the mundaneness of his neuroses, and you then see that guy put the crumpled tissue down, and Hannibal's just disgusted by his bad taste. Like, and then they cut to the scene with Hannibal and Will where they're talking about, Jack Crawford's talking about Freddie Lowndes having gotten a hold of information about the Baltimore strike and published information, and Will's comment is, it's tasteless. And then Hannibal starts talking to him about taste, but it's like, he's just so tantalized by him and feels such an affinity with him. And like the attraction is just very, very, just very powerful.
Immediately. And Mads's face as Hannibal, for Hannibal, is such a, you know, that scene that you're talking about where he's so disgusted with Franklin for putting the tissue on the glass table. Mads can have like, almost, he has almost a resting disgusted face, right? Like, and if you're inclined to see him as disgusted, you could easily see him as disgusted. And he doesn't have to do anything, right? He doesn't have to do a thing except move his eyes. And that sort of, that kind of quality that he has to make you wonder what he's thinking just by sitting still, and that desire that other people have to please him and be around him, is really in evidence right there, just in that moment, right?
Yes. It's very interesting about you talking about his face, because, you know, I mean, obviously Mads is a very, very stunningly beautiful man, but there is something about him that's very alien looking. Like, he's sort of too perfect, and he looks, there's something unreal about him, that almost inhuman about him, just in his physical presence, his bone structure, his everything about him. You know, you almost want to look at him and say, like, this person is not of us, and he isn't of us, not because of the way he looks, but because of who he is.
He has a real and, David Bowie quality in that way, right? Like the man.
Yes, yes, unearthly. He's unearthly looking. That's exactly right. And when you talk about, you can sort of read disgust into his resting face. I mean, you can really also read superiority into his resting face. He's superior. His presence is superior. His appearance is superior. His mind is superior. And you just see it. So the performance, the casting of him as Hannibal, which is sort of an off the beaten path kind of casting, is just so brilliant.
I think there's a lot of pressure on that casting, because you had, there's no denying that Anthony Hopkins just owned that role. And that the first time you see Hannibal's face, it's really lit in a kind of a Frankenstein's monster way, right? I think it's either lit from below or lit from above. But anyway, the shadows of his eyebrow ridges are really well pronounced. The shadows of his cheekbones are really well pronounced. It's a real, I feel like there was, I'd love to talk to the filmmakers about that choice, because I think there's a lot of pressure in, okay, we're going to show you Hannibal's face for the first time, and you're going to have to believe that this is a different version of Hannibal that's worthy of your attention and is a worthy monster. And I feel like that Frankenstein framing and lighting it's a real statement. It's just a very strong reveal that establishes him as not Anthony Hopkins. You know?
Yes.
And And of course, it establishes that his wardrobe is just amazing. The way he ties his tie. I learned how to tie that knot after watching a few episodes of Hannibal. Like, it's an amazing way that he ties his tie.
Everything about him is so pristine and so specific and perfect, and also in his office. Yeah.
Do you think when Jack Crawford first comes to his office, like, he seems absolutely giddy to be in his presence, and he's just plotzing over his drawings and the decor in the office, and he's just like, and he's saying to him, he really blows smoke up his ass. Do you think he's genuinely giddy to be in his presence? Do you think he's blowing smoke up his ass? Or do you think it's a combination of both?
I think it's probably a combination, but I think it's mostly blowing smoke up his ass. Like, I think Jack Crawford just knows how to get what he wants from people. And I mean, I'm sure Hannibal knows every single thing he's doing. It's sort of interesting, though, because Jack Crawford is equally in true. Like, Jack Crawford, what he does when he first approaches Will by going into his space and touching his stuff, like, he's alpha dogging, right? Like, he's just pissing on Will's stuff and saying, I'm here. And he does it with Hannibal, and Hannibal, and Will recoils from it, right? And, you know, and Jack is going to be able to exert some level of control over Will. But he does it with Hannibal, and while you can imagine Hannibal would not want Jack Crawford touching his drawings, he's implacable when it happens and just engages as if everything is normal and is not behaving in a way that allows, well, that gives Jack Crawford any dominance over him. He just treats it like, oh, this is a normal thing to do, to come in and start looking at my things.
Though his reaction, there is one reaction he has, though, that's a little beyond that, but in a very subtle way, because his reaction is actually to pick up a knife and show Jack Crawford how he sharpens his pencil, right?
Yes, yes, yes,
so while
yes.
It's very quiet, Jack Crawford, yeah, he does try to alpha dog him, and Hannibal's reaction is to pick up a knife.
Yes. Yes.
Right.
Yeah. Very interesting. Yeah. So I was kind of thinking maybe what I would do, because of course my instinct is I just wanted to start binging and watching every single episode. Like, I wanted to just go right into the next episode. But I thought maybe I would rewatch the episode with some note taking, and then when we come back, we can talk about other stuff, some other things in detail.
Okay.
I mean, there's a lot to go over. I mean, there's just we haven't really talked about a lot of the visual stuff and the style, and I think that would be interesting to talk about. I mean, we haven't talked about Alana Bloom. I guess we can come back to her and the forensic team.
Good.
So maybe we should leave this here and continue, like, tomorrow. We'll watch the episode again and continue tomorrow.
We've each rewatched the first episode, but also given ourselves time to digest it after the initial instant reaction that we had. And I have a couple of thoughts, and I know you have a few thoughts. So why don't you start, and we'll see what happens.
So one thing I wanted to discuss with you is we had talked about how one of the things that may have been initially off-putting to us is that really the rules of time and space and sort of logistical possibility in the show do not abide by the rules of our universe.
Like that somehow Hannibal manages to go to Minnesota, kill someone, impale them on antlers, and get back in time for just to chat with Will.
Correct. Yeah. So I think those kinds of things may, or Elise's body having been put back in her bedroom.
Yeah, no one noticed.
You know, the last crime victim. When they say they've been in and out of her bedroom all day, like they specifically say, we've been in and out of her bedroom all day. The police have been there. So I think those things initially, if you're looking at the show with an eye to it being akin, more closely hewing to police procedurals that we know, those things feel strange. But when you sort of, when you embrace this universe, you embrace its rules and you accept its rules. But I was just thinking about how from the very opening of the show, they're telling you that time and space are not what you expect them to be. I mean, the first thing that you see is the crime scene. And then you see the pendulum swipe, which is Will going to his fugue state, which is time taking us backwards. And the crime scene reverses. And then it goes forward again as he's reenacting, you know, in his mind as the killer, reenacting the scene. And then you realize this is not actually even happening. This is Will telling a class about this happening in the present. So you have all of these very strange backwards, going backwards and forwards in time, which is somewhat disorienting, except I think it's a signal from the very start of the show that time is different here. And I thought that was interesting.
I agree. And I think that's definitely, it's such a deliberate, I mean, it's such a striking opening for the show, right? You, the, in the, from the first moment, you're in a crime scene, Will is covered with blood, we're seeing the pendulum, time is running backwards. It's, and that's all happening in the first 60 seconds of the show when you don't even know what it is. It's really does try very hard to plunge you into this strange world where time and space don't make sense. So I really agree with that. That makes a lot of sense. I think I have an extra, so I kind of want to build on that a little with something that I was thinking about a lot, which is that, yes, time and space doesn't make sense in the show, but also I think in particular, we're being told that time and space doesn't make sense for Will, and we're being told that Will doesn't live in the world that we live in. And there are a couple of things that that made me think about that as I was rewatching the first episode and thinking about it more. One is something that you really notice when you cut from the initial murder scene to the class lecture, or actually even from the initial murder scene when Will is having a fantasy to the moment when he says he needs the report of the burglar alarm, the alarm report.
Yeah.
And this is something that I guess I sort of knew but hadn't really thought about, or something that I'd sort of subconsciously noticed but hadn't really thought about. The colors in Will's fantasy reconstruction of the crime are much richer and well saturated. It's actually, the colors are very warm and looks like real life in a way. And then when you cut to Will asking for the report, for the, you know, the transcript of the alarm call, the colors actually bleach out. Things become much more stark. They become much more overexposed looking. They get a little bleached looking. Will has great color in his face during the flashback. And when you cut to real life, he looks very washed out and tired and haggard. And the same goes for when you see him in the lecture. So I think for Will, the world of fantasy and the world of reconstructing these, the world of applying his empathy to reconstruct these crime scenes and identify with the killer is actually a richer, warmer, more real experience to him than being in the quote-unquote real world. And I thought that was a very strong visual signal to let you know that from early on.
Yeah, I hadn't noticed that, but it makes a lot of sort of visual sense and emotional sense. And certainly this show tells a lot with visuals and with color and with framing and, you know, just cinematically. And yeah, Will's interior life, which he keeps hidden, is much more his real life.
And it relates to another thing that I wanted to talk about which I didn't really mention when we were doing our instant reaction to the episode. And you can tell me whether you think this is me trying to like something I didn't like about the show, or whether it seems valid. It also relates to Will's to the way the show shows that Will doesn't really belong in this world, or that his fantasy world is a more comfortable place for him than the real world. And that is the forensic team that surrounds him. I forgot completely that they existed since my last watch of the show and this rewatch of the show. They are not something I think about at all as being part of the show. I remember from the start, one of the things that put me off about the first episode was the forensics team. They, for a couple of reasons, one, which is just a thing that I just don't like in general, which is the overt expository dialogue and the fact that they function as this sort of chorus to just kind of tell you what's going on, and then Will gets to react to it. But so they're sort of the play-by-play, and he's the color commentary. But I never liked them. I never liked the casting. I never liked the way their performances. I just really never warmed up to them. And I remembered that as I was watching this first episode, and I was like, oh yeah, these people are in the show. And to me, they just always felt like a bunch of LA actors dressed up like a forensic team and saying like forensic team lines, but they just never really feel like they felt to me like they inhabited those roles, or, and this is my point, even belonged in the show. Like, I felt like they were almost like they dropped in from some other more standard forensic TV show and are visiting the world of Hannibal. And I never really warmed up to them for that reason. And they always seemed very artificial to me, whereas like Will and Hannibal and Crawford and all the other characters really, really seem to inhabit their roles in a way that this forensic team doesn't. All right, so I'm going on about this. But the point for me, I think, was that actually a deliberate choice? Like, is the contrast between Will and his weirdness and sort of this solemn sort of absorption he has in the task, and the fact that like he's so different than them, and the fact that they're like, hey, we're a forensic team from a TV show. It is the contrast between him and them deliberate? Because is it supposed to feel like Will is, that's how Will feels when he's in the world. Like the rest of the world feels a little artificial and fake to him. And he just doesn't, they just don't belong together in the same space. Do you think that's deliberate, or is that just me trying to like an element of the show that I just never really liked, and I'm trying to forgive the show?
So it's hard for me to say, you know, there were things I thought of too, that, like, for example, when the Beverly Katz character first meets Will, there's some dialogue that just feels so artificial, where she's like, oh, you wrote the monograph on, you know, dating time of death from insect activity. Like, it's just such a weird exposition. And then this thing about, oh, are you unstable? Like, it's just a very strange, artificial, it's just a very odd, artificial seeming exchange of dialogue. And then later, I thought something else was very strange to me, which is when they go to Garrett Jacobs Hobbs's house, there's a title on the bottom of the screen that says resident of the suspect, Garrett Jacob Hobbs, which is something they do in Silence of the Lambs sometimes to orient you, but it's certainly something you see in basic police procedural television shows. And I was just thinking when I saw it, well, we know this is Garrett Jacob Hobbs's house. You know that's exactly where they were going. 2 seconds later, a woman's going to come out bloody and collapse on the porch dead, or she is already on the porch dead, I can't remember. And Will's going to start screaming, Garrett Jacob Hobbs, Garrett Jacob Hobbs. So I just felt like this is this very unnecessary, like, title that they put on there. And I just kept thinking, is this a deliberate attempt to make us feel here's a normal construct of a police procedural and it feels out of place and it's wrong here because that's not what this is? Or was this just in the pilot they were using basic police procedural tropes as they were sort of feeling their way towards what the show was going to become? It's hard for me to say which is the case. In terms of the forensic team, it feels legitimate to me that because of Will's reluctance to be sociable, which is overtly stated, his interactions with other people are going to seem weird and feel weird, and a kind of thing that we see as normal, because again, it's a familiar trope, to him is very uncomfortable and artificial and alien. So I don't know the answer to the question. I certainly think there's a way of reading purposefulness into it. I don't know if it was purposeful. I think maybe as we continue to watch the forensic team, we'll have a better sense of that. I guess you'll see if you like them better
this time around.
This time through.
Yeah.
Yeah. But that is interesting. Yeah. Like that the fact that Garrett Jacob, that title on the screen is so unnecessary and it seems like an artifact from some other type of show, and that and then Will just crashes up against it, right? And you're just like, yes. Oh no, this isn't that. And maybe it is deliberate, maybe it's inadvertent, maybe it's just a happy accident. You it's hard to tell, but it does if you want to forgive it, you can certainly forgive it by saying it was deliberate. You said something, too, that just reminded me of another thing I wanted to talk to you about, which is when she does first talk to Will and say, you wrote the monograph on blah, blah, blah. That's certainly the way people introduce themselves to Sherlock Holmes, right? You wrote a monograph.
Yes.
I loved your monograph on tobacco ash or whatever, right? Like those kinds of things. And also when Will is talking initially, I think it's to Jack Crawford about his method. Will says, well, the evidence is all there. I just put it together, right? And he has this peculiar genius for knowing exactly what went on based on like little bits of evidence that you could barely see or that an ordinary person wouldn't put together. So I guess it's not much, it's probably not even that insightful an observation to say that Will is, you know, a descendant of Sherlock Holmes for that reason, right? Someone approaches him and says, you wrote this monograph. He has this incredible deductive ability to just like walk into a room and figure everything out right away. And then that made me think a little bit about the fact that you are, and I am not, but you're a big fan of Sherlock, and that Sherlock is treated in Sherlock as kind of, someone who's on the spectrum and has trouble with human relationships. So I was curious to just hear your thought about the treatment of those two characters in the different shows, and do you feel like they're part of a continuum? Do you feel like this way of treating these highly deductive characters, these sort of brilliantly insightful characters, as kind of on the spectrum, is that just a good modern way? Is that just like almost an inevitable way of interpreting them in the modern world, or is there something else going on there that's maybe even more deliberate?
You know, it feels like with these characters that are descendants of Arthur Conan Doyle, A.C.D. Sherlock Holmes, there's always something in them that's broken, which is not true. I mean, I suppose it's true of A.C.D. with his cocaine, because he's a cocaine user. But yeah, there's always something that's broken about them. There's always something that's wrong with them in terms of their ability to relate to people. You know, you can also look at a character like House, right? I don't think you ever watched House, but he's clearly also a descendant of Sherlock Holmes. He is brilliant. He makes deductions. He is a drug addict. He's irascible. He's unkind to people around him. I think the interesting thing about comparing BBC Sherlock to Will and Hannibal is I mean, BBC Sherlock for me went awry, you know, in later seasons. But you have this character who's based on a character whose deductions come from his ability to engage in pure logic, unemotional pure logic. Although there is, you know, one Sherlock Holmes story where they sort of talk about his heart and his emotions. You know, Will is in a way the flip side in that of original Sherlock, in that his deductions don't come from pure logic, but come from pure empathy. They come from emotion rather than logic. You know, BBC Sherlock, and I think any modern interpretation, takes that character to someplace beyond their professed pure logical technique and personalities. So BBC Sherlock really did do that with the character of Sherlock. The character of House gets investigated emotionally. And I think that's something that modern interpretations of characters like Sherlock or characters that are born of Sherlock kind of have to do, because we don't, because we're just much more psychologically minded when we look at characters.
Yeah,
But I will say, one thing I will say is, when you brought this up with me, when you mentioned this to me, I did go online and saw there was quite a few fan videos of comparing Will and BBC Sherlock, and they were very enjoyable. So that gave me some entertainment. Oh,
maybe I'll have to check those out. For this project we're doing, I'm actually trying not to read anything else anyone says. Like even if we're repeating things that other people say or whatever, I just want everything we talk about to just come out of our reactions to it. And I know this won't be the last time we talk about this. I mean, another parallel, really obvious parallel between Sherlock Holmes and Will is both of them have a doctor companion, right? And this symbiotic relationship with a doctor. And that, of course, and I know this won't be the last time we talk about this, BBC Sherlock went out of its way not to acknowledge the sexual and romantic undertones of their relationship, whereas Hannibal does not go out of its way, right? Like Hannibal really, really embraces it, and BBC Sherlock seemed afraid of it. But the fact that both have a doctor companion and you know, there is this really intimate relationship between these two men is something that was handled so differently, and it's very interesting. And I think we'll come back to that, but plenty of times.
Yes, I will say also I am avoiding reading anything as well. But when you brought that up to me, I did have a very strong sense there must be crossover fan fiction, and I wanted to find out if that was true. And of course,
it was. Well, that's good to know.
One other thing I wanted to talk about, and this is also just expanding on something we talked about before, is this idea of how people are seen, how they see others, and how they see themselves. And I realize that there's just an enormous amount of conversation about seeing and self-definition and definition by others in this pilot episode. And I just wanted to talk about a few of those. Mm-hmm. When Will is speaking to the class and he's describing what happens to the woman after she's shot, he says she can feel pain. She just can't do anything about it. And I think that's a very good description of how Will feels about himself. And his voice is breaking when he's saying that. So you can say it's, you know, because of his empathy for her and the situation she's in. But I think it's also part of what his personal pain is. Of course, there's how he defines himself as being on the spectrum, which I think is just kind of an easy shorthand and actually keeps people away and stops them from exploring him and psychoanalyzing him further. Mm-hmm. Like he says, he builds forts, he tells Hannibal later. And I think you can even say that this is a fort he builds, that he just makes this sort of easy categorization to say, oh, now that's what that person is. I'm not going to look at him further.
Oh, so you think that that initial bit of expository dialogue that I was sort of objecting to is less a signal to the audience and more of a signal to the people that Will is interacting with to just say, okay, here's who I am, and now you understand me, and, like, you know, let's leave it at that, but it's shorthand.
I think it certainly can be viewed mm-hmm. that way. There's also how Hannibal defines himself and other people. In his session with Franklin, he talks about, you feel like there's a lion in the room who's about to devour you. You have to convince yourself that the lion's not there. You'll know when he is. And I mean, that's a pretty good description of Hannibal. You know, he'll later talk about himself, or I think Bedelia will later say he's in a people suit or a human suit.
Yeah. And he almost overtly says that to Will when they're having breakfast together, right? Will's trying to blow him off and says, I don't find you that interesting. And Hannibal's like, you will.
Yeah, I think that's both. I mean, Will's sort of lying when he says he doesn't find him
Absolutely.
That interesting, because he immediately then just starts engaging with him intellectually and kind of gets very excited and even then asks Hannibal. I mean, when Hannibal tells Will, this is how Jack Crawford sees you, the fragile teacup that only gets used on special occasions.
Will loves it.
And Will, and then he's amused by it. He likes it. And then he asks Hannibal, how do you see me? So, like, we've seen this guy who says he doesn't want to be seen. We know he's afraid of what his interior is, of exposing that to other people. And here he is very quickly asking Hannibal to see right. him. You know, you see Jack Crawford. I had forgotten that Jack Crawford's initial interaction with Will when he invades his space is he adjusts Will's mm-hmm. glasses, which is also obviously about seeing. And I think it's like telling Will, see me as somebody who's going to be exerting some control over you as an authority figure. After the Garrett Jacob Hobbs killing, Will is looking at Hannibal leaving in glasses that are spattered with blood. So I think that's interesting. It's the way... I mean, just those glasses as a very simple but beautiful symbol of how he sees and how he sees different people and how different people have created his vision of them. There's the thing about Hannibal saying, you know, I can help Will see the cannibal's face. And then the cut to the copycat murder, which certainly helps Will see the face of Garrett Jacob Hobbs. Mm-hmm. But Hannibal's also, I think, talking about, you know, I'll help him see my face. Yeah. And maybe I'll help him see his own face.
And of course, when Will shoots Garrett Jacob Hobbs, the last thing he says is, you see.
And I also thought, I don't know why I hadn't paid much attention to this, but you know, the first conversation Jack Crawford has with Hannibal is he talks about his article on the origins of social exclusion. Mm-hmm. And I think, of course, so much of Hannibal's attraction to Will, and I mean, this gets spoken about overtly when he's in therapy, when Hannibal's in therapy, is that he's an alien in a lot of ways, but he wants connection. Mm-hmm. And Will is a person who he can connect with, even though he's incredibly manipulative and sadistic and deceptive and all of those things. He does crave connection. Mm-hmm. And he's really looking for a soulmate. And that's certainly yep. Will.
And I think it's also worth noting here that the first serial killer that the two of them team up to bust is a cannibal himself, and that
yes,
and that it's very clear to both of them that he's eating people to get closer to them. And
yes.
Hannibal understands that. Will understands that. So it makes it's a very good way to kick off their relationship.
Yes. Can we talk for a second about, I have a question about Winston the dog.
Actually, let me just, I wanted to say one more thing about the whole thing with seeing. I think actually,
yes,
that's a theme that obviously infuses the show and really infuses this first episode. Credit to that, I think, really goes to the source material. Because having just watched Silence of the Lambs and Manhunter in preparation for this, and I read the books Silence of the Lambs and Red Dragon a long time ago. I don't think I'm going to ever revisit them, but just having rewatched Silence of the Lambs and Manhunter, that theme of seeing infuses those, and looking and seeing infuses both of those movies and both of those stories. It's like the main thing, right? Like, and we'll get to this later with when we reach the Red Dragon storyline later in Hannibal. But Francis Dolarhyde is all about being seen and not being seen, and allowing himself to be seen and breaking mirrors and putting them in the eyes of his victims so he can see himself in their eyes. And also in Silence of the Lambs, there's a lot of voyeurism. The killer, you know, James Gunn became a killer because he was spying on people and coveting them. And of course, in Silence of the Lambs, Jodie Foster, wherever she goes, Clarice, wherever she goes, people are staring at her. Either they're leering overtly at her and hitting on her, or when she's just walking through the room, there's very, very deliberate choreography that shows people are always looking at her, either quickly glancing at her, checking her out, sizing her up, or overtly leering at her and hitting on her. So I think... using this source material, that's one of the best things about this source material, is that theme of seeing and being seen. And it infuses both really good movies built on the source material, and it infuses this show too.
Yes, and of course, having Lecter be a psychiatrist and the tool of therapy and analysis as a means of seeing oneself and having oneself revealed is just perfect. Yep. So this is the question I wanted to ask you about Winston. He's has a leash on when Will picks him up on the road. It's like a rope leash, but he seems to be owned by someone, which I just thought was very strange. And I don't think there's necessarily an explanation for it, but he's running down the road with a leash on, and I thought it was odd. But one thing I did think was interesting is that Will, you know, Winston won't come to Will initially, and Will goes and gets food to attract Winston to him and to, you know, allow Winston to come to him and allow him to exert control over Winston and to make Winston part of his pack. Then Hannibal turns around and does the exact same thing to Will.
Mm-hmm.
He lures him with food and does win him over that way pretty quickly. So I just thought that was an interesting parallel. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, as a dog owner, I think... I did notice the rope leash, and I think that was actually a way of saying this dog may be owned by someone, but by someone who doesn't deserve to own the dog. It's because it's a dog uh-huh. that's just been tied up with a shitty piece of rope in a backyard, and he probably broke out. And you know, he's better with Will. And I also think for Will to have established himself in the show as on the spectrum, there's almost kind of a Temple Grandin kind of element to his character where he relates better to animals than he does to humans.
Yes.
And he can have the warmth and the caring and the first thing he does is he gives the animal a bath, and it's very intimate, and he's obviously more comfortable with the love of animals than with contact with people.
I wanted to talk about something, visual that I noticed, which is, so I remember watching this for the first time and the scene of Jack Crawford confronting Will in the bathroom. It's a bizarre looking bathroom. It's very odd, and I don't even know what style you would describe it as being, but it's got these sort of orangey red walls that are sort of striped with white. And later you'll see Alana is wearing the same color outfit. It's sort of an orangey red outfit. Then later when Hannibal's doing therapy with Franklin, that's the color of the walls of his room. They're painted that color. And then when you're in Hannibal's office, the curtains are like sort of an orangey red and white stripe. And I mean, I guess it's blood, or I don't know. I don't know what else to make of it, but it certainly seemed the bathroom, I remember having a reaction to the first time I saw the show, because I was like, this is no bathroom that would be at any school or any FBI building. It just seemed very incongruous. And I think, again, this is just the rules of this universe, and that the style isn't consistent with the place is just something that we have to accept in this world. But I think the consistent use of that color really, really struck me this time. And I just think it's maybe reminiscent of dried blood, but I don't know what else. And I don't know if you have any thoughts.
No, let's watch for orange in future episodes. Let's see how orange gets used. I think that's a clear connection, but let's watch how it gets used. I don't have any immediate thoughts about it. Although when you bring up the bathroom, I did notice that too. I felt like the bathroom is almost from Stanley Kubrick universe. Right?
Totally.
It just feels like it's from The Shining, or maybe from 2001. And maybe the design of it just owes something to Kubrick, but it does really feel like it dropped in from that kind of universe. Like in that bathroom, you could almost see the door open and blood pouring through, right? If you know,
yes.
And actually,
yes.
The opening shot is there's blood in the sink. One other stray observation I had was when we first meet, and obviously we'll talk a lot, I assume, about the food design and food styling in the show, because it's just exquisite. The first time we see Hannibal eating, there is a slice of pomegranate and a fig.
Yeah.
And that just reminded me, too, of, you know, of the Garden of Eden, that a lot of people say that the forbidden fruit was that the apple was actually a pomegranate, and obviously fig leaves, this idea of knowledge and corruption. Those two things representing knowledge and corruption in the Bible, I think that can't be an accident that a fig and a pomegranate are present the first time we see Hannibal eating, right?
I love it. Yeah, I didn't think about it, but I really like it. Yeah, and right from the beginning, both when we see Hannibal eating and then later when we see him cooking, you know, the show is really already making us complicit, because everything looks so beautiful and delicious, even though it's human body parts. So that starts right from the beginning. And also, you were talking the other day about how the first shot of Hannibal's face is very, very deliberate, mm-hmm. And framed like sort of shot from underneath. But he's introduced, you're right, by food. Like, you see the food before you see him. The camera pans back actually to like a reflection of the food, and then to the food, and then to him. So I think he's introduced by those specific foods and food in general, because that's what he does. He consumes others.
That's really all I had.
Yep, I think that's mostly what I have too. But I have to say, I do think I got a lot out of watching it a second time and taking some notes, just because the first time it was really just purely pleasurable to watch it, and I just wanted it to sort of wash over me. And this, to sort of watch it with a closer eye, made me think about a lot of things I hadn't thought about initially. I will say though that even watching it twice in a row, the episode is so captivating and so thought-provoking and so visually arresting that, like, when I would go to take a note, I would pause. I just wasn't letting it continue to play because I just wanted to see everything and hear everything. And it's just that good.
I think even more so watching it the second time in a row. Like it's like you don't want to miss a second. There's just so much, there's such rich material there.
Yeah, it's pretty great.
Well, that's why we love it, and that's why we're taking the time to do this.
Okay,
All
so
right.
I guess we'll come back after the second episode. Amuse-bouche.
All right.
To me. I mean, it's one thing to say, let me splash some cold water on my face, but like you really do see this happen in movies and television all the time, both in public sinks and private sinks. And it absolutely bears no relationship to reality for me.
I agree. It makes no sense.